Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Awesome.
Hulk.
Now, Rob, Corbin, would either of you like to do the introduction to the show?
Corbin would love to.
Thanks for volunteering, Robert.
Yeah.
Did I volunteer you? I thought I was psychic and I could actually read your mind. I was like, oh, well, you really wanted to do it. No, I was kidding.
I do love it when guests volunteer another guest, though. That's priceless.
Okay. G'day, and welcome to episode 143. We have Dan.
Credit as Zephyr. Never gonna send you spies, never gonna nuke your guys, never gonna run around and denounce you.
Robert.
Hey, guys. It's awesome.
Philip,
what together to get more land.
And myself, Paul.
Started by Blitzkrieg 1980 and it's titled My Rational Fear of Tech Inferiority. Now, the opening post is a little long, so maybe I should go with it in a nutshell so that we don't TLDR in an audio show. That's great. Basically, he feels like whenever he falls a little bit behind in technology, and this is on Monarch for him, but any time he falls significantly behind in technology, he feels like he's doing terribly, that he can't see how he's going to win. And often we'll just restart. Basically his question is his fear of being on par with the AI in terms of tax irrational, or, you know, is it something that's important to doing well in the game, essentially? And my answer to this, and this is actually a fairly long thread already in terms of responses, considering it's pretty new, but my answer to this is that it's not that important. And if you have enough land, or if you have some other means of winning the game. For example, if you're AP cheesing, then you can be behind in tech as much as you want. If you have a production lead and you're in the mid late game, for example, you have infantry and artillery, you can kill pretty much anything with that. Same with nukes. And once you have nukes, it really doesn't matter what they have. As long as you can first strike them, prevent them from nuking you in return, you're good. So, it's a little bit irrational. Now, if you're a small empire, you really need to use the tech lead to break out and get more land. So, if you're falling behind on, like, 4 to 6 cities, then you probably need to adjust play to some extent. But, yeah, the game is far from over if you're on tech par with your rivals. Far from over. There are lots of ways to get out of that. Say, be it bulbing, be it military backstabs, or, you know, just... Well, those are the main two, honestly. But you might be able to pull something else out, too. Maybe like a culture win or something.
Yeah, I read this thread and in the opening post from Blitzkrieg, one of the things that he said that he didn't realize was the case when he said he had tech trading turned off, so I couldn't see what technologies the other ships had. And if you get Alphabet, so then you go to your foreign advisor, click on tech, and not only will it show you what can't be traded, especially when you have tech trading turned off. So that tells you what it is that they have, but it also shows you what they can research. Now, he was talking about actually before Beyond the Sword, but now, even before you get Alphabet, if you can see another civilization's research, then you can also see that information under the tech screen. Further to what Phil was saying, though, about his actual situation, rather ironically named given the response from Voice of Unreason, but this is rather, I think, a rather reasoned response, the problem was that you lost the tech lead. Problem was that you were playing blind. And I think that was the first part, because in that particular game, he talked about realizing, oh, I didn't know that they had this particular technology, and therefore I didn't know that this is what they were going to land with, and that was it. But also from Kananda, do not mistake cause and effect. The games posted here, so I'll talk about the forums, aren't won because they got a tech edge. They got a tech edge because they had already been effectively won. And from Archon Wing, a tech advantage is merely that, a mere advantage. If you don't take advantage of it, it will start to decay, and so will your chances of a win. If you are behind in tech, and yes, it does depend on what victory you're going for, also get an idea by having a look at your demographics, having a look at your relative power of your economy, your production, and of course, Espionage and Civilization 4, you can check out, again, their relative power, their economy, their production from the graphs, and get an idea, also even just from scouting the best that you can in their land, whether that's got open borders or you've got spies running through. Have they started to leverage that? If they have a particular technology that you're concerned about, now they can build Macemen, for instance, and they've got machinery and civil service. But have they actually started to build Macemen, or like the AI likes to do, have they done their insta upgrade already? And where are those units if they happen to be on the front that you want to attack? Are you going to be able to leverage perhaps just greater quantity of lower technology units? There we go, which, by the way, if they have sufficient promotions on them, can be just as good, if not better, than newer age units off of the line. So it's a matter of that in and of itself, it's not a reason to go, oh, game over. But have a look at where you are in that particular moment and then decide what it is that you need to do to best put yourself in a position to defend, if that's the situation, or in fact, turn it around again.
Do you think this was a bigger issue in Civ 4 with the tech trading?
I guess tech leads in Civ 4 could be more devastatingly applied, perhaps. I don't know. Tech still matters a lot in Civ 5, but with the way stat combat worked, you could just completely screw people if you could, for example, draft rifles. You like make an army out of nothing in 10 turns, and they just can't respond to it. And so maybe it was a little bit more of an impact in Civ 4. But yeah, I would say a lot of that advice would still apply in 5, certainly. You're still going to want to have an overarching strategy, and you're still going to want to know how to get there, like how to get to your goals once you have an overall strategic goal.
Yeah, but building a line, a front line with Civ 5's one unit per tile makes a difference then.
I would say so, yeah.
I think it makes a big difference because the catapults, and you can use a lot of things from Civ 4, if I remember correctly, to be able to break down the stack. And in Civ 5, the battling, the one tile per turn, I think, is more strategic, honestly, in the battling. With talking about the tech leads and not being a tech leader, I think it matters more not to be to have a certain technology, like, for example, having Macemen or reaching a certain military unit more than a science building or a culture building or anything else like that, because you want to be able to defend your civilization so you can grow and catch up or expand or take over or things like that.
Now, in that regard, I would say that the tech lead actually is more important than Civ 4. And say you have some longswords, but you're trying to push a line of archers or catapults plus swordsmen. It's not going to be that easy to break it unless you have, like, comparable numbers of swords. Or, you have something else that lets you attack into that line. Otherwise, it's going to be pretty difficult. You're still going to take some losses there. Whereas in Civ 4, you would just attack and you would probably kill quite a few units without them being able to do anything because they don't have a counter unit that's available based on the technology they have. In terms of tactics, I wouldn't say that Civ 5 is necessarily more complex, but it's definitely different. And some of those differences are favorable. Tactics makes a much bigger difference in single player in Civ 5 than it does in Civ 4, certainly. But it's a pretty big deal in both in multiplayer.
No, I agree. It's strategically different. But, it's just, I guess, tomatoes about how you want to do it. But I think a lot of people have said that, Civ 5, one unit per tile is not, like, as favorable as the stackable units. But I found that in multiplayer games, especially since I've been playing multiplayer for the past, 6 months or so, you find that the tactics of it, you never really get, like, bottlenecks of units as much as you would think, because you're constantly attacking. It's a constant war. In, like, even FFAs or in 2v2s or duels or anything like that. Like, it's usually a constant war in some way, shape, or form. And so the one unit per tile and the strategic advantage of the tech is generally, I think, more important for having a certain military unit because so you can grow your economy and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would agree for that for both games. Both games, I would say that's very critical.
And I would say also with Civilization 5, it's partially more dependent on the type of victory condition you're going for. But, I mean, the context of the Civ 4 threat and a lot of what we're talking about here is, if not domination, then at the very least war. Whether it's, you're thinking about a different victory condition, but I need to engage in this war and I need to get rid of this civilization or I need to cripple this civilization because I think they have a better chance of getting a spaceship victory or a diplomatic victory, whatever it happens to be. when you are on that tech press, if you're worrying about technological superiority, to me, I'm looking at Civilization V, yes, you want the technologies that are going to give you the better military units or different military units or even the ability to build different types of military units. But also, as you're expanding, there's also that happiness issue. There's the happiness issue, the big one, of course, when you get to 10, minus 10 or more, when you're, not only is your growth slowed in your cities, which you get between minus 1 and minus 9, but you've also got that combat penalty. And even if that civilization that you're attacking is behind you, if you let that unhappiness go on for too long, and you're realizing, there isn't a social policy I'm going to be able to adopt that I can improve my happiness, or there isn't an additional resource that I can trade, or there's an additional resource that I can acquire, then you want to be looking at technologies that are going to give you buildings and or national wonders or even world wonders that you're going to be able to construct, so that the cities that you acquire, even if they remain puppets, that they have a chance to grow. And by growing, then those new city acquisitions are going to be able to be more than just quote-unquote land, just cities, that they're actually going to be able to contribute to your production, contribute to gold, which in turn ties into your ability to continue to be competitive as far as your technology goes. So to me, the technology, it's not just about having a technological lead overall, but having a technological advantage in different branches of the tech tree. There's that balance there.
I mean, I agree that happiness is very important, but the problem is that it's really hard to use negative 10 happiness if you do it correctly. Because the reason is that you have the powerful building of the circus, of the Colosseum that comes early in the game. If you plan on luxury, such as a mining resource luxury, it's extremely powerful in the first two cities. I try and plan on a mining resource luxury, so when I'm going teching to ironworking to get my first swordman or legion or whatever, or mohawk, I'm trying to keep my happiness up. So basically, playing on luxury is an excellent way to kind of prevent you getting to that negative 10 happiness. And also, building the circuses, one of the most powerful buildings, I think, in the game, one of the most underrated buildings in the game, to get plus 2 happiness, no maintenance, and it's a cheap building to build.
With a lot of games, well, depends on the strategy you're playing, because there's different things that you can do. I don't always get that fear of taking priority. Sometimes I just, you know, like, I'll just go for, like, a cultural game or something like that. And I'm not so much worried about my technology. I'm focused on other things such as the happiness of my people, which does a big deal for the development of your civilization anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that the happiness issue is not as big of an issue as the military unit, because if you're not happy and you're still – usually what happens also when you're not happy is you start being on production focus, so you can produce more units. And you get higher production, like, so you start working your mines more often because you're not working your 3-tile granary or 3-granary resource or 4-granary resource. You're working your mines and things like that. So you can push a little bit more. You can try and expand. You can try and take over resources. You can try and build up coliseums and circuses and theaters and things like that. But, I think that honestly, in the end, I don't have a fear of tech inferiority as long as I have a unit that's strong, like a, I can't really say so much for Civ 4, because it's been a while since I played it, but for Civ 5, for example, artillery, swordmen, rifles, infantry, tanks, nukes, things like that, it's very important to get to before the other team.
I definitely feel that,
As long as you can survive, you're good. You're still in the game, as long as you have enough military that you can stay alive.
Yeah.
That will apply to both games.
Yeah, but I definitely feel that, I had more of a fear of taking inferiority when I was playing Civilization 4 than 5. I don't know if it's that I've improved my gameplay or if it's like the technology trading and the fact that there was a stack of Doom involved.
I think it's more a question of dated units are more useful in Civ 5 than 4. Because you can still do major damage or even kill more advanced units without taking major casualties in Civ 5. Whereas you can't really do that in Civ 4. You know, if they have maces and you have axes, you have no means of killing maces without losing any axes. It's impossible. There's nothing you can do. I mean, the best you could do is slam a stack of maces with catapults and then attack with the axes, but you're going to lose a good 8-9 catapults if you're attacking a stack of, say, 10 maces, you know, before your axes get guaranteed, or at least close enough odds to, you know, sweep that stack. Whereas in Civ 5, you start softening, like, an AI unit that pushes you with a couple archer shots, surround it a little bit to get that flanking bonus, and then, you know, you can wail on it, and you're, you know, your first sword might take some damage, but you're going to kill that longsword with just archers and swords, and you're not going to take any losses from that unless they have a full-on organized front and execute it well against you. So you can make a lot happen with dated units in Civ 5 that you couldn't in Civ 4. And maybe I would say that research agreements are a little bit weaker than tech trades, but I think it's a lot of the same. Yeah, it's basically a replacement mechanic, and it's still too strong relative to the rest of the outputs that you can get in the game.
Yeah, you can definitely defend your territory easier in 5, even with much less superior technology than your enemies. Yeah, it definitely helps not having that stack of doom anymore.
Well, I have to somewhat disagree on this because it's true in game theory also in real life. Like, for example, can a swordman take on a longswordman in real life? I mean, can they? Yes, they can do some damage to him. I think that it's important that, you kind of take the realism of, like, history and, like, the future and the current and the past. That's what makes Civ so immersive, that you have, for example, a swordman could attack a longswordman in real life and do damage with archers, if they had, like, upgrade archers. And I think that the maintenance costs that you pay for the outdated units makes up for the difference of having to have a less tech unit attack a future tech unit, because I consider it maybe just getting upgraded units. Like, for example, we call a frigate nowadays in, like, the U.S. Navy a lot different than a frigate was, like, 200 years ago or whenever they had frigates back in the day. So it's still a frigate, but it's a lot different now.
Okay, but still, you know, at the end of the day, you can still kill a lot of units with the dated stuff. And yeah, there's a bit extra maintenance there. But also, you have the ability to upgrade that's much cheaper. I don't know. It just seems like you can recover from war attack deficit more readily in Civ 5 than you can in 4.
The technological superiority. You think about, you know, Civilization 4 versus Civilization 5, and which is more important? And in terms of my play style, it's pretty well domination and conquest. So I look at it from that perspective. If you are in a situation in Civilization 4 where the other civ has greater technological superiority, I think that you are at a bigger disadvantage than you are in Civilization 5. Now, there are exceptions to that. I mean, in Civilization 5, yes, there's the one unit per tile, yes, the siege, and with the archer units, it's better. But in Civilization 4, because you can have that stack of doom, if you have the technological superiority and the units and the sufficient volume of units to go with it, then you are in a better position. But if another civilization has technological superiority, but they don't have sufficient units and or they don't manage their units very well in terms of grouping them, hello AI, then you can actually press that advantage because your quantity is better than their quality because they don't have as many or they're not managing it as well. But in Civilization 5, if your technological superiority isn't as great, it's not as big a threat, at least not immediately.
I think that depends. I forget a lot about Civ 4, but I think it depends about what technology you get. For example, artillery is extremely powerful, or crossbowmen, or machinery is extremely powerful. Just to have that unit to be able to take over and have that rage unit, or even rifles or cannons or things like that, it's extremely powerful to have.
Started by Netgear. After getting bored of Civ 5 once again, my friends have suggested we play Civ 4. We played various MP modes before, but this time we'd like to try co-op against the AI instead of competing against each other. There's 4 of us, so having all of us on the same team would be way too overpowered, probably split to 2 groups of 2s and compete economically. So I've been thinking of what would make a good synergy as a duo. Does anyone have experience with this mode and can share ideas of what I can do specifically to make co-op playing better? Ideas like picking civs with 4 different starting technologies, for instance, that you wouldn't consider in solo play, and etc. 2 general comments right away. First off, having as a team game, co-op is... I find that overpowered. I mean, when I think of co-op, I think of informal teams against the AI, in part because, I mean, yes, you're cooperating, but that better translates to me in your single-player mode or even in competitive MP mode if you're not actually on a team. Most of the time, I'm not saying never play on a team, but I just think that kind of skews things a little bit. Second of all, you use the word synergy. really? Okay, I'll move on. I have to kind of say that. I'm sorry.
It's okay if it's actually applicable to what they're describing.
Oh, the word is just brewing for me, like paradigm and paradigm shift. Anyway, I'm going way off.
does he say what difficulty he wants to set the AI on?
No, he hasn't, and you're right that is an important factor. He hasn't even indicated what difficulty level he and his friends typically play in single player. So, all right. So either whatever difficulty level, just generally, or even I guess we could think about it in terms of what difficulty level each of us play at.
A lot of that depends. You can run teamers, but then raise the difficulty of the AI or team the AI up as well, and it still can be challenging, potentially, especially if someone on your team is playing poorly and holding you back. Because the way teching and team works is you don't get double research because the techs cost you more to reach, and you have a shared grade person pool. You know, there's a couple considerations like that. Where, you know, it slows you down a bit. Now, it's still beneficial to be part of a team. You're going to have faster research than you would otherwise, but it's nowhere near double. I think you get, like, a 1.5 cost multiplier with two people or something like that. So, you know, you need to be pulling on your weight in the team, and if someone isn't, it can actually slow you down and be problematic. And not only that, you have shared war wariness and a couple other things you want to consider as well. So, if you want to do teamers, it's definitely a different thing from the base game. That doesn't make it bad, but it's different. And you can't approach a teamer the same way that you would approach playing as an individual civ, whether or not you're colluding with humans to defeat AI or otherwise.
I think one of the most important things written here by Netgear is that after getting bored of Civ 5, once again, my friend suggested to play Civ 4, is why he got bored of Civ 5. I find that a lot of people, this is a great time actually to plug my site, I think, awesomeciv.com, is that basically my site is dedicated to improving the multiplayer experience. People come to Civ 5 and they say, man, I'm going to join a multiplayer game and say, okay, well, I'm going to join a public game that's on the server, and oh my gosh, 5 people quit. Oh, wow. I mean, it's just that people sometimes just don't have the time or commitment. They're not as committed to the game. And for serious players, that can be a real frustrating, extremely frustrating situation. So basically, there's leagues out there that you can play in, like NQ and Civ players, where you can not get as bored. You can play teamers. You can play co-ops. Honestly, teamers are one of the most fun things to do. I mean, just to be able to talk and communicate and having that extra dimension of the gameplay is just huge. It's so much fun because you have to not only manage what you're doing, you have to see what the opponent's doing. You have to see what's map-dependent. Like, I mean, basically my strategy is map-dependent usually, and so all that stuff kind of comes into play.
Yeah, I've had a lot of bad luck too with the internet multiplayer for Civ 5, whether it's just really laggy or it just kicks me or kicks all the other players. Yeah, it makes it really frustrating and difficult.
It does happen, and I want to say a solution to this that it hasn't been brought up by many people. If you join a league such as NQ and Civ players, maybe it's just that there's not as big of a multiplayer base right now, but I truly feel like the future of Civ is to make it multiplayer, to make it so people aren't playing against AI and trying to trick them, but trying to play against people that play and think similar to you. Playing a human being is going to be totally different than playing AI. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, a lot more unpredictable as well, especially if you don't know the person. It's a lot better playing against humans, definitely, if you can find them.
Speaking cross-promotion, there's another show on the Polycast Network called Turncast. And what that is actually listening to conversations taking place during cooperative Civ games in Civilization 4 and Civilization 5. Sometimes a couple of games of Civ 4, Civ 5 going on at the same time, or some people in Civ 4 and some people in Civ 5. But we're all on the same call. And I think, yeah, the first step is, and what Corbin and Rob have been getting to, is actually finding people who are not only interested in multiplayer, but interested in cooperative multiplayer. So whether it's joining a league or finding a Steam group for Civilization 5. So I think short of, I'm fearful of forums. Like, I just want to have what the game gives me in terms of a means. I think it's easier to find people for Civilization 5 than it is for Civilization 4, particularly when it comes to co-op, in order to be able to have that conversation about, in terms of, would you be interested in setting up this game? I'll add you to my friends list, or we can just coordinate through the Steam group because there may be more people that would like to join in. But then actually talk to them. Like, don't just be typing back and forth. This is a chance for some socialization. Whether you're using Civilization 5, you can use Steam's voice feature, but it's only between two people, and I've found the quality to be less than desirable. It's just terrible. use something like Skype, which what we're, I mean, it's free software. You can have multiple people on the call. The quality is generally quite good. That's what we use to record Polycast episodes when we have our cooperative games. When you listen to Turncast, that is Skype that you are hearing for that conversation. And then once you actually get a chance to talk to the people, it's, when it comes to cooperative play, it's not just about, of course, what you're doing in the game, but how you're talking about what it is that you're doing in the game. Because it's important to be able to discuss, especially if you've got two human players side by side and you're not on formal teams, that you have to have that dialogue about, okay, where are you relative to me? Where is the AI? This is the AI that I would like to go for. I would like to expand west towards him. Please don't expand towards me. Expand towards an AI that's closer to you so that you're not having that competing space. And then have a conversation about, okay, how is the war going? How is your planning going? You can be trading advice and giving suggestions on, you know, I see that you don't have enough workers in your empire. Or you have enough workers, but why? How come you're not doing this? Or how come you're not teching that? Or this is what I'm doing and this is not, you know, this is what's going well. It becomes very much a social exercise where what's going on out of game can have just as much impact of what's going on in game. And yes, it can be good and bad. You may think, okay, talking to this person, it sounds like we want to have the same thing. Or you agree to kind of in-house rules, you know, for example, that you don't expand towards the human player in this situation. Or I know there are some people that say, oh, so after the AI is all taken out, if it's just humans versus AI, then we can go after each other, right? Or we can try to, quote-unquote, grief each other in order to improve our position. You get an idea of what the personalities of people are like, and then you can decide whether or not, okay, I do want to play co-op with this person again, or I don't. But I think, yeah, that first step is, in short, finding people to play with, which we've talked about, and having that conversation, move it beyond simply text, and then at the end of that experience, decide, okay, what worked, what didn't work, how can we improve on it, and do I still want to try to improve on it with the same people? The weekly games that you hear covered on Turncast, we've been doing these for more than 3 years. It'll actually be 4 years in October, November, December of this year.
Yeah, and you actually get, you know, actual diplomacy and teamwork with human players. It's definitely worth getting into, especially this, you know, over the internet. Because, like, in person, it can be difficult. Personally, I've found it very difficult to find other people. Like, I've got friends who like the game or have interest in the game, but they're either too busy or I don't see them very much. So finding other players is really helpful, and you'll experience a lot better gameplay that way.
Well, if anybody out there wants to try out multiplayer, don't try it out with a public game. Try it out with a league or something like that. Try it out with any league. It's really beneficial, I think. And it just makes it for much more immersive, better experience. And like what Dan said about, you know, when you talk with a player, another player, it's almost like when you get to play with certain people in the league or whoever you play with, even if it's just a group of friends you start to get to know through Civ 5 multiplayer, you get to know, like, their strategies. You get to, you know, a feel for them. You get to say, okay, well, what's the tech path that we could probably do? What are the 3-4 tech paths we could do to kind of get to certain wonders or certain units or certain strategies based upon the map, based upon the civilization, based upon your goal, based upon your culture? I mean, it gets so in-depth to a point where you're almost constantly talking during the entire game about how you can improve. And you talk quickly. You learn different ways of saying things quicker than usual. It's almost like the game evolves to another level almost. It's really great.
And even if you're on a formal team, you know, against another team of human players, then you and your teammate or teammates could also be on the call and coordinating strategy, and perhaps the other team is doing the same thing. Either way, it's a social opportunity to me as much as the game, because you get to know people's personalities and you get to know them beyond, you know, how they play in game and, you know, how they respond to certain topics, certain suggestions, what they say, how they say it, how often. You can even better anticipate what that person is going to do, or you get to know someone. If you run into difficulty in your game, you know who to ask for assistance. Either, can you come and help me finish off, you know, the AI that I was going for because I'm having difficulty, or can you tell me or suggest something that I can do to improve my game in the moment or even afterwards? So you're that much better off again, and you're having that enjoyable experience, because I find that even if you quote-unquote lose, and you get into house rules about who wins and who doesn't win, and it's more
yeah,
kind of like, actually in Civilization V as opposed to Civilization IV. It can be more difficult to quote-unquote formally end the game. And in our games for, as you hear on Turncast, it's based on score, which of course, as we know, is a perfect measure of your performance. But it's just a means to say, okay, you quote-unquote win, and then afterwards, it's one of those situations where you can go back and say, okay, how did the game go? What can we do different? With Turncast and our cooperative games, when all the AIs have been eliminated, or in Civilization IV, if they're still around, but they've been vassalized, for example, that they're no longer a formal competitor. Okay, the game is over in Civilization IV. All those who have a lower score than whoever's the highest, or if two people have permanently allied, that everyone else below vassals to them and the game formally ends, or in Civilization V, it's just, okay, the person with the highest score, you win. Even when you lose, you win. I mean, yes, you can lose and have an absolutely terrible game, but even if you're doing poorly in the game, you can still have a decent conversation if you get to know these people and your personalities don't clash.
Definitely agree with that. I mean, it's a lot of fun. It really is an enjoyable experience to play. And I just have to say, Civ 5, it might be easier than you think to decide who's the winner, because while it doesn't always go on points, it goes, like, for example, the leagues I play in. I don't understand Repcast. You might have to explain a little better and all those things. But basically, there's defined rules that say whether or not you win or lose. And usually it's through domination, science, or things like that. I mean, you can win a diplomatic victory in FFA, and I've never honestly seen a culture victory, to be honest with you, but because usually the game's over by then. But it's possible. I've heard that it's possible to do. So it just depends where you play and what you play, like what format you play. Because usually it's to concession in a league game. It's a concession where someone concedes or everybody concedes, and it's definitely, you know, when I find, at least my games at Civ 5, when I win, I win. If I lose, I lose.
For Turncast, or Revcast being our another podcast that we have for Civilization Revolution, for Turncast, the reason that we look at score and in Civilization 4 people vassalizing is then when that happens, then the game can formally end and we can see the replay. And so then we can see how each civ actually managed turn by turn what was happening. Oh, that's what was going on at that time. And actually even more advantageous in Civilization V when we get to that with the absence of map trading, for example. So, you know, you could be eliminating, you know, your civ, and then you just kind of sit back and you're waiting for the other human player to finish off their AI, or there's an agreement that, no, you're going to go over and help. And a score was just a quick and dirty means to say that someone wins. We could actually get to the end game and the replay, that's all. There's friendly competitiveness in terms of, you know, oh, my score was larger than yours, or my empire was larger than yours, or, you know, I had the best economy, you had the best production, I had the biggest population, you're the farthest in the tech lead, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea is that the competition is about improving your game while hopefully also seeing other people improve their game. You're going to spend a lot of hours with these players if you want to see the game to the end. So you need to be able to quote-unquote stand somebody as much as possible in cooperative play if you actually want to get to a point where it felt like it was worthwhile. You've got to be able to relate to these people.
Agreed. I mean, in people that have grudges against other people because of the competitiveness of the high level of play, I mean, when you get to a high level play of anything, you get to competitiveness and you want to win. You want to be number one. That does cause friction and problems. But in the end, I mean, I found that most people play with most people in the league and, like, NQ and things like that. Like, most people are willing to play with other people. I mean, it's more sociable than you think if you actually take advantage of the resources that are out there in Civ 5. Mike Dean writes about on GameRanks about how Civ 5 DLC is done right. He basically explains Firaxis has basically provided DLCs to improve gameplay and to give a more immersive experience to be able to buy a better game, if you would say that, if you would be willing to say something like that, go so far as that. And I mean, whether or not I agree, I mean, I think I agree that the DLCs are amazing because while they're, some of them are overpowered, I mean, such as Babylon, I think is extremely overpowered, and while there's still some balance changes to be done, I think DLC is an excellent way to make Civ 5, maybe Civ 5 is one of the last Civ 5s ever created, and then they just create DLCs and expansion packs from there. I'm sure there's going to be a Civ 6, of course, but I'm saying that before then, you'll have the ability to, there'll be more of a seamless transition. It won't be a, you know, here's an expansion pack, wait a year and a half, 2 years, and or longer, and maybe get another Civ. You'll be able to get different things and different ideas from the lead designers at Firaxis and things like that. Like, if Ed Beach thinks that, okay, well, I want to, you know, make a DLC that does this, he can do it now. And I think it's great. And it's also cost-effective. While I think they're a little expensive, you know, $50 for a few DLCs is expensive, I think the given the option of purchasing them like that is excellent.
Yeah, definitely having them available. And also, DLCs can really spark your interest back into the game as well if you're having a bit of a game drought. I think that it's a good idea. And sometimes it can be something that you're really interested in. Like maybe someone was interested, you know, really particularly interested in Babylon as a civilization with a science advantage, and that got them back into playing the game.
If you pick a certain Civ, you got to make sure you build your strategy around, you know, what's your strength, like what's going to be your peaking moment in the game.
Yeah, definitely. And with Babylon, yeah, you don't want to let them sink their roots in, because then they become a problem.
I do put a question though. What would you do at writing with Babylon? This is kind of getting off topic a little bit, yep. But the DLC. What would you guys do with the Great Scientists for Babylon when you get it at writing? Would you plan an academy? Would you save it for technology because you have to pay upkeep on that the scientists? Or what would you guys do? I found that academies probably work the best, but I'm not sure yet. I haven't really worked it out.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile going for the academy. Sometimes you might be at war at that particular moment and you want a technological advantage, and then you could just, like, I don't know, you don't have gunpowder, you could just immediately have gunpowder and then upgrade your troops and then give yourself the upper hand. So it can work really well the other way, but if you're, you know, earlier on, you want to really build up your science, then Academy would be the best option, I personally think.
Okay. Do I think that DLC should be in patches? I think a lot of people have said that, you know, you shouldn't have to pay for these things, but, you know, it takes programmers time and effort to make these things. It's not, nothing comes in this world for free, you know. People give up their, you know, time and be able to produce these great games at Firaxis for us. And I think that it's a very, I'm not trying to shortchange it or say it's expensive. I'm just saying that, you know, that they do a good job. I think DLCs are excellent, really good way to add gameplay and different experiences and just really improve the game.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's always nice to get stuff for free, but they have put a lot of work into it. So, yeah, it's quite reasonable for them to ask for money, especially if it's a big deal, something that really improves the game. Then they're asking for money, of course. You know?
Exactly.
How much would you pay for a DLC that you really liked?
I'll be honest with you, when it came out 50% off, I bought all of them. I paid $25, I bought every single DLC, or $26, bought every single DLC, and I really enjoy them. Even though they're overpowered as heck, I only play public games with them. I say public games because I play sometimes publics, meaning, like, for example, when you start playing in an organized league or any type of situation where organized friends or whatever situation you want to go into, you'll find that you'll become better than an average public player. Like, you'll win 90 to 100% of your games. Literally, and it's really a lot of fun. But I mean, when you play even an overpowered Civ on top of that, it gets to be out of control. That's why I try not to play it, but it's a lot of fun. You go, you know, Spain Inca or Spain Babylon, and you get 1500 gold, and you get the science thing. It's just almost impossible to beat, but it's a lot of fun, and it's all good times. And but yeah, I think that honestly, for a reasonable price for a DLC. I mean, I don't know what the factors are, and I mean, I'm a finance guy, or at least I got a degree in finance, and then basically, you have to, you know, the time value of their time and how much, you know, money or how much time they're putting into the game, how much programming efforts, like how much they pay their programmers, how much they do that. So I mean, if they're allotting it for it costs them $5 and they want to make a 20% profit margin, then, you know, they have to make it a certain price. Now, whether or not I think that, you know, it should be $250 or $5, I mean, I think, honestly, $50 of DLCs for your 7 DLCs isn't that much. I mean, overall scheme of things in life, but it's just the principle of it is that, I mean, if I pay $50 for a game, I don't expect to pay, you know, more than $50 for, less than $50 for the DLCs or something like that when it only adds just a Civ. So I think that maybe it's a little bit overpriced for the DLCs. Maybe if, like, they all came out and made a like maybe a package deal instead. If you bought all of them, you get like a 30% off or something like that. We're going at semantics here, but I think
incidentally, you don't price in firm theory. You don't price based on a desired profit margin. You price based on what would maximize your long-term profits, or you know, short-term if that's what your goal is. But generally, you'd price to maximize long-term. And so there's a certain number, and it does take some experience to find it, where, you know, you'll sell X times, you know, Y amount and get you the most value. And that's what they're going to be looking to price it at. And that, you know, that number, you really can't set a profit return on that. You have to go with that number. And then it just becomes a matter of estimating, okay, or am I going to be able to get an acceptable profit margin on this next product? And then if you feel like you can, then you do roll out another DLC or another product or whatever. So they're going to price it to get what they can. That's how businesses operate.
You know, profit margin is important because they have to figure out the expected value, what their return is going to be, because they say the net present value of saying like, okay, well, or future value saying like, okay, well, I can invest in, you know, T-bills and just have cash like Microsoft does, or whatever they invest in. I don't know what they invest in, but let's say Microsoft has a lot of cash or Apple has a lot of cash. They have to say, do I want to invest in this DLC or do I want to invest in something else? And I have to get a certain required return other than the fact that maybe saying that my branding, saying like, okay, well, I'm going to build this DLC just because I really think that my fan base would like it. I mean, maybe we take not a loss, but maybe we break even or just meet our costs for now.
Definitely incentives to choose popular ideas.
You definitely want to look at opportunity costs when you're deciding what you're going to invest in. But I'm just saying, you don't price based on that. You price to get the maximum returns for the product, and then whether or not you do it is based on whether or not you estimate that it's your best investment or not.
True, true.
Now, people are wrong. It happens, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, because you only have a certain lifespan of the game that you're going to be investing in. So it's not going to be like forever that you get this return on investment. It's going to be a certain limited amount of time until either another game comes out or maybe you just continue with this game. But I doubt it. It's probably going to be a Civ 6 out, hopefully.
Yeah, and that's why you see prices drop eventually.
Yeah, they definitely dropped. I mean, I saw that Civ 5 was like $750. I almost bought a few copies just for friends to play with a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, it's not, the price is really an issue. I mean, and we're dealing with just the price of whether or not, it's just the principle of the matter of how much money you want to spend on something. And honestly, the price point for each person is different. I mean, it's a tough economy right now, but it's getting better. So I'm pretty excited about that, too.
Earlier, Rob mentioned AwesomeCiv.com, and on AwesomeCiv.com, there is some Let's Plays for Civilization V. There are a number of Let's Plays for Civ titles out there, whether it's our very own The Minion Team's Civilization IV Let's Plays or Imagine's Let's Plays, but we're going to start with here. Rob, what made you start creating Let's Plays, and why for Civilization V?
I have to give a shout-out to Builder for the Win for helping me set up TaxKey software, which is a free software device, and he did a great job in helping me learn about Let's Plays. He actually has a great YouTube channel. If you YouTube Builder FTW, you'll see Let's Plays in there, and he has about 10, 15 Let's Plays with over like 6,000 views on it. And the reason why I decided to start doing it is because I wanted to build a website where it was beneficial to the multiplayer community. If you look at my website, you can see that there's three different ones. And I wanted to do one that was a 2v2 or a teamer to show what it's like, one that is a free-for-all to show what it's like, and also one that's a duel to show what it's like. I mean, those are basically three different ways of playing Civ 5, in my opinion, fun. I mean, I honestly, at this point, after playing multiplayer in competitively for over like 6 months now, and I've been playing since Civ 1. I think Civ came out in 92. Was that it?
The original Civ, 1991.
91, so I was 9 years old. Why did I wait till Civ 5? It's because I didn't know that there was a multiplayer base for it. I never looked at it. Every time I looked at the multiplayer thing, there was no games up. I didn't understand it. It was just like, why am I playing this? And then Civilization itself, I used to get bored after a certain amount of time because I didn't like to play at a higher level than maybe even Prince or King, because after that point, you're taking advantage of the AI more than being strategic with your decisions. If anybody out there really wants to see a good example of what beginner multiplayer should do, I think Builder and I hit it on the head. This game versus me and Builder versus Lord Gracchus and King David, which one of them is actually ranked higher than me now on Civ players. I think we did such a good job. I'm not tooting my horn here. No, I'm just kidding. It's just an excellent way of saying, like, the city placements, battling, what you think about long-term decisions, short-term decisions, what your strategies are, what happens if your strategy doesn't work. It was 40 minutes long. I taped it in double speed.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Okay.
Lord Gracchus and King David, they picked Russia, and they drafted first. We generally do drafts, too, or mirrored sieves to make it balanced and competitive, because I found that if you just go random, the chance of luck coming into play, it's more fun to try and pick your sieve. And so you ban a few sieves, usually six, and then you pick four sieves. So it goes 1-2-2-1 order, meaning like the first team picks, the lower seed picks first, then the higher seed picks, then the higher seed picks, then the lower seed picks. So you get the highest thing, and you can counterpick as the weaker player, the weaker team. And it just makes it more fun games. We had to factor in, you know, how can we beat Russia's production? And we ended up going with Aztecs Rome, the glory of Rome, and for Rome, obviously, an Aztecs growth bonus, and also the Jag Legion. Now, they had the powerful civilization of Greece to be able to counter that, so it's worth your time, and it really will show you the benefits. Other videos that are in there are just two other videos, NQ Game of the Week. It did show how you have to have balance, like you have to balance your military with your education, and then the duel that I have, great thing with Fredotto, who's probably the consummate leaguer.
First game there, the 2v2, and you've tagged it on your website, is excellent for beginner players. But would you say that even though that is targeted to beginner players, that there really isn't a specific target for your Let's Play in the sense that you're going to try to cater to beginning players, intermediate players, advanced Civ 5 players, so that all members of the audience would be able to get, you know, wherever they're at in terms of their play, would be able to get something out of what you're making available?
That's my long-term goal. But, I mean, this is what I want to start with, because I want people to understand what the different types of gameplay there are. Like, for example, 2v2, FFA, or duels. Like, these are examples of how you play. I'm not trying to cater to any one audience. Now, while I say that, you know, this is the first video is for beginners, even though it says excellent video for beginner multiplayer players, I still watch it occasionally or listen to it while I play to kind of reinforce what I said to make sure that I'm doing it the right way, to learn something different, have I improved my gameplay, and things like that. League and NQ are extremely competitive, so it's going to be tough to find a perfect scenario where everything's perfect. But generally, 98% of the time, everything works well. Everything is a lot of fun. It's really enjoyable, and I recommend it to really everybody.
Some of your Let's Plays are also different from some other Let's Plays where you're not the only person that's commenting on the video. That you've got, for instance, your teammate on there talking about what's going on. Is that a conscious decision, or that just kind of happened incidentally, or?
Well, I talked to Builder, and I said, Builder, we should do one where we talk together, because I think that, while if you get to know me, I'm the most easygoing guy you'll know, but I am picky. I mean, I am, like, literally, I'm extremely always pushing the envelope. I'm trying to make things better. I'm always trying to do something different.
I know how you feel, Robert. Whenever I play a game, at some point, I always reach a point where I start thinking of ways the game could be improved, whatever game it is.
Exactly. I mean, it's just like in anything you do in life, really. If I think that if you don't learn in life, you're not living. Be content in life and be happy, I mean, I think. But, I mean, at the same time, look at it from a perspective of how can I improve the surroundings or what's around me. That includes games. That includes people's opinions. That includes, you know, what the even though in the end it's Frax's decision what to do with the game, the players are the ones that buy the game.
How do you balance focusing between playing on the game and making meaningful commentary? I mean, in other words, are there times when you're thinking about, oh, I would like to do this because it would give some more dramatic effect to it? Or are you thinking more about, well, I'm going to play the game like I normally would. I'm going to do my best to comment on what's going on. And maybe in the end that makes for some more interesting viewing or maybe less interesting viewing after the fact.
We comment after the game's played. So if I was to play a Civ players or NQ game and I couldn't focus completely and utterly on the game, I would lose the game. You can't comment like in single player. You're having time to, like, you know, make your move and things like that. You have to literally focus your time and effort 100%. And it makes for shorter games, to be honest with you, I think, in the end, because you're pushing through the turns, and it's just more immersive, more fun. And I really think that it's just a great time.
What advice do you have for anyone looking to start their own Let's Play for Civ 5 or any other Civ title or any game for that matter?
Be honest with you, be ready to learn. Be ready to have the learning curve. You have to first find the tools that are going to allow you to build what you want to build. Just like if you're a mason and you're trying to build the pyramids, you have to have tools. Taxi software and Windows Movie Maker. So these are two free, excellent tools at your disposal to be able to make it. And honestly, don't just make a Let's Play just to make a Let's Play. Have a goal in mind before you make the video and go for it.
Recorded for episode 114.
What made you get started doing Let's Plays before and for Civ 5?
Actually, I was inspired by the Mean Team channel. Because it taught me how to play C4 basically. I mean, I've read all the forum posts and all the games and all the and I looked at all the screenshots, but then I realized that the only real way I'm going to master C4 is if I look at the videos, and then I started playing C5. And I was struggling with it at start, and then I played and played and played, and finally I started to actively seek out videos on YouTube about C5, and most of them were horrible. I mean, really horrible. and then I decided to, well, except Phil's, of course.
good save, yay!
But most of those videos were like from when the game was released, and they were really
outdated at least.
Yes. And then I decided to make my own. I learned how to play C5 on my own, with some, of course, help with the forums. And I simply wanted to transfer my knowledge to other people who might, you know, find it difficult, like I did, to learn how to play the game.
And I gotta say, as a Let's Player, I'm impressed with your work, Bibor. When I looked at the same other Civ 5 Let's Plays as you did, and oh man, they don't finish their games. That's probably my biggest gripe with a lot of the uploads, is they just never finish the game, or even come close. You know, they'll just get started halfway through, and then there's just no more channel updates ever.
Yep. A lot of people ask me why I did this, or why I did that, or why I didn't do this when I could, and so on. That's because I'm trying to play the game and to talk about things in a way, you know, it's all real time, so there is not much thinking involved. I'm trying not to give false information to people. And I've seen this as a major flaw for most of the Let's Plays out there. The authors or the guys who are making these videos simply aren't thinking about the repercussions, about what will happen if the viewers actually try to implement their ideas and their concepts into their game. I'm trying to maybe be a bit dumber in my decisions when I make them, but I'm playing safe. That's why some of my games drag out too long, and I sometimes go for victory conditions that are not optimal for my current situation in the game, and so on.
What would you say is the biggest adjustment you had to make when you went from playing just offline by yourself to trying to essentially give a running monologue and doing a Let's Play online? What was the hardest thing for you to do in terms of adjusting to that? I'm curious.
Talking about it. That was the hardest part, because I noticed that when I started to record my first game, I would simply do things that I usually do, and I didn't see any reason why to tell what I'm doing to myself, and then I had to remind myself that I'm not doing this for myself. I need to say what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and I'm still struggling with that. I'm still trying to adapt to that, although I made some improvements. Need to play and to explain stuff, not just what's happening now, for example, why I'm building this farm, because it's obvious that I'm building a farm, but why I'm doing it in the long term. What are the long term benefits of placing that farm there and not someplace else, for example? So that was the biggest change. Nothing else, really.
And then you run into an interesting consideration, which is the pacing of your explanations versus the pacing of what you're playing the game. Because if you get into every little detail on every decision, including, like, if you just assume that your viewers know absolutely nothing about the game, you can wind up spending probably triple the amount of time just talking about playing while sitting around doing nothing. So that's I don't know how you balance that, but that's always been a challenge for me.
I thought about that before I started recording, and the way I balanced it is that I give every game I play, I give it a theme. I give it a topic, and then I focus stuff that I'm talking about. You know, I try to talk about a topic. For example, in my Inca game, I was talking about the theme was economy and empire management. It wasn't warfare. And that was mainly what I was talking about. In my Caesar game, it was supposed to be a warfare game, so I was talking mostly about strategy and warfare and unit types and so on. So that's the way I balance it. Obviously, sometimes you will have gaps when nothing else is happening and you have to fill in with some non-essential information. But I'm trying to stay true to my theme in all my games.
On your YouTube channel, you note that you're 33-year-old in Zagreb, Croatia, and you've listed under About Me, along with journalist and civilization fanatic, marketing and DTP specialist. And I read that, I thought, you're a disturbing peace specialist? Well, that is quite the... I know, that's what I'm like, wait, I must have some other meaning. Is that...
It's one thing anyone can aspire to.
Is that actually this distributed transaction processing? Is that what that actually means?
No, it means desktop publishing.
Oh, it does. Oh, okay.
It's a relatively old term used for computer-aided graphics, but focused mostly on magazines and paperback publishing.
You offer your videos in high definition as well, so you maximize it on your screen. I realize it's also kind of dependent on your video card, blah, 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 and your monitor resolution, but you actually feel like you are in the game.
Yes.
Yeah.
I record at full HD. Unfortunately, I cannot upload it in that resolution because it would take me a day on my internet connection to upload one half an hour video. So.
Well, you don't do anything else with your internet connection. So what's wrong with that?
Yes, but
well, Dan, what if he wants to download Polycast?
No, it's not just that, but
upstream, it's all good.
Even that isn't the problem. The problem is that YouTube connection can time out, and it happens.
Yes.
It happens quite often, and it can even happen on 99%, and it's quite fast. It's really frustrating.
Unknown error.
Yeah, exactly.
I like a few on my bandwidth.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for joining us. This has been Polycast episode 143. I am your host with the most trolling, and joining me today has been Dan Q.
We're no strangers to deals. You know the rules, and so do I. A full commitment's what I'm thinking of. You won't get this from any other leader.
Bravo. All
right, I now rescind my title of most trolling, now granting that to you.
Credit to JP Bar 81.
Also, guest co-hosts, Hawk.
Honored.
And the awesome me.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
So I guess we'll hop right into the Senate today, a little bit of strategy.
Okay, Phil, can I just interrupt you for a second? I'm sorry, you're
yeah, sure.
Doing that breakup thing again.
Oh, it's a good thing you told him.
Yeah, I'm hearing it, see.
The strategy I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, just watch if you want to. But so
spoiler!
Yeah, spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Important question. Now that you've been a guest on the show, would you be willing to come back?
Let me think about that. No, I was kidding. No, I'm
hard to regain my trolling title.
think Dan just beat up on you a little bit there.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. I have to work hard and regain it. He took it from me. I have to get it again.
I got to tell you, I had planned to say that even before you said that, and that just made it all the more sweeter. I appreciate that.
Did he knock you off your stool, Phil? Were you like, oh, man, I was going to say something really cool, and then you're just like, he just went up to you, and you're like, I can't even say
anything. No. I was just like, oh, wow. Because that is kind of the most trolling, and then he goes and does that. I'm like, well, whatever. Well, let's roll with this then.
That's awesome.
Record day, March 21st, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.